the current situation we face, you say in the book, is a result of the poverty of our practice.
Yes.
That's very potent, to put it that way. Can you elaborate?
Yes. I think really the Zen perspective is, immensely suspicious of the following kinds of intellectual moves. That we have some fixed human nature, we should figure out what it is, and then make our politics based on what we assume to be true about our human nature. That's always a scam.
What's an example of that?
I would say justifications for capitalism are an exact example. So capitalism, which will probably participate directly in the auto-extinction of our species, how is it ultimately justified? Well, human nature is self-interested. It has first and foremost, if we're honest, itself as its primary concern. This is what modern philosophy called the conatus, the endeavor to preserve and enhance yourself. So that we're self-interested, greedy agents. And so capitalism is a way to take our fallen, greedy human nature and help it enrich everyone. You know, the rising tide that lifts all boats and all these other scams, the invisible hand, all these ways in which we've abdicated our responsibility for who we are and what we are. And how we are in relationship to the earth. Zen does not start with human nature. It starts with all of the interdependent relations that comprises who we are. And that way, I think it lends itself very nicely to science, to all these kinds of studies that try to understand ourselves more systemically. The earliest way of naming that in the Buddhist tradition was something like karma. I use that word very advisedly because it's easily misunderstood, and I don't want to come across the last minute like I'm pulling out some superstitious mumbo-jumbo. But karma is just something like our prevailing background conditions that enable us to be the kinds of creatures that we are. Those are ecological conditions, a kind of like a climate, if you will. A climate makes possible certain things within that climate. If you shift the climate, you shift what's possible in that climate. And so...
And the climate is shifted through one's practice.
I think we can see our karma clearly from the ecological emergency, because our practice is capitalist, self-serving. You know, we like getting rich, and so therefore we retroactively make up a story that justifies what we're already doing. It was not like, wow, we discovered there were a bunch of greedy SOBs. What should we do? Oh, I know. The best way for us not to destroy ourselves is capitalism. That didn't happen. It was the other way around. It was a fact of capitalism. And when we saw what we were doing, slavery, genocide, empire, exploitation of the workers, total ecological devastation, then we said, well...
That's human nature.
That's human nature.
It's just the way it is.
And I think that's just bogus. So Zen is really to practice deeply on who we can be by practicing deeply on our relationship to these background conditions, improving these background conditions, but also improving our awareness, our openness, our honesty.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that this would be a critique of right-wing thinking or right-wing ethos, and yet the left wing is really into an identity politics, which just even saying that is a loaded thing,
yes.
But basing things on identity and for the, I think the impulse is a very good one because
yes.
People of color in this climate, women in this climate, gay and lesbian people in this climate have certainly gotten the short end of the stick.
Yes.
And yet, you to talk about Pope Francis again, he says the most abused entity or orphan on this planet. I don't think he said the word orphan, but the
poorest of the poor.
The poorest of the poor is the planet itself,
yes.
Which is a living thing.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, identity politics, first and foremost. On the one hand, I understand and am sympathetic to the political expediency that gives birth to that discourse. And so, in limiting its ultimate value, I don't want to suggest that it has no value. It might be the best that we can do under very, very anguished circumstances, under a brutal history that we in no way seem willing to confront. Things are only getting worse on these fronts. So I get the battle for that battle. I do think, however, that long term it's not going to serve us well. If the background conditions that make this discourse politically expedient are themselves addressed, identity politics will also keep us from seeing other aspects of our prevailing problems, and that is a more karmic, systemic, earth-oriented, by that I mean not that we're on the earth, but we're the bioregional, interpenetrating, co-evolving, co-enabling conditions of a place. And not just how we appear within a political ideology as we fight for our life. Now, I want to say, people are fighting for their lives. And that political ideology, so long as it's in place, will give rise to these things. But I also dream of a less ideological relationship to each other, a less ideological sense of politics, a less mega state underwritten by crazy ideology, way of being with each other and with non-human animals as the places that we are.
Hashtag heterotroph solidarity?
Yeah, for sure.
Your book is part of your practice. And absolutely. And the lack of academic jargon in the book was intentional.
Yes.
And you're a guy who, you can use jargon with the best of them and have used yes. jargon with the best of them, but chose not to for this book.
Yes. I've never, ever loved jargon. If by that I mean we say in a more complicated way what can be said more straightforwardly. One of the things I love about Gary Snyder is he's deep as all get out, but he believes in straight talk. You know, if you can't say it straightforwardly and you have to hide in mumbo jumbo, go back to the drawing board because...
I'm reminded of a bumper sticker that said, eschew obfuscation.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old medieval logical fallacy. Do not explain the obscure with a further obscure. You want to shed light on things. So I've always been, although I've been trained, of course, in super jargonese, that's one of the sub-languages of all philosophy, one of your foreign languages that you learn to speak philosophies. But it's of no service to students. It's of no service to the reading public. It's sometimes used to allow philosophers to speak in mantras rather than in clear ideas. And really, for me, philosophy always is about the what test. And the what test has two aspects. Exactly what are you talking about? And then, more importantly, so what? You know? What are you saying, and why are you saying it? And you have to be crystal clear about that. What's motivating this discourse? What motivates a lot of philosophy is, well, it's what we do. We're philosophers. It's just, right. We just hide in the crowd of people already doing this, and if we're all doing it, it must be worth doing. But I don't know. I think philosophy is a life and death issue. And if we're not crystal clear about the problems that we're trying to solve and we're hiding in mantras or we're writing in a way that only exactly your 10 peers working on this problem can read, I don't know. I think, you know, writing is also the art of becoming a, this is my mixed Zen metaphor, it's the art of becoming a pinata. You're out in a limb. You're all out there. Where are you, you know, you're not hiding where you stand. And of course, you are going to be attacked. And I say, bring it on. And tear me apart.
And I'll spit out candy.
It's full of candy. You walk right into my trap.
What is underlying that urge to hide behind jargon?
Looking at ourselves. Looking at who we are.
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability is power in Zen, and not just in Zen. I mean, I think even that's a deep, deep reading of the Christian traditions. The power of Jesus was vulnerability, openness,
humility.
Exposure, humility, not the Roman power of the sword. It's absolutely the case in Zen. You know, what first appears to be strong, the rock, the mountain, you know, that which shows its power by being able to maintain its place, you know, stubborn, dominating, is in the end shown to be weak. And what first appears to be weak, water, vulnerability, is shown to be strong. It washes down the mountains. It gives mountains part of their movement. It's also associated with compassion. Compassion is also the art of becoming vulnerable, exposed. But being exposed, that means also in this country exposing ourselves to some very ugly things. I would say one of the deepest fruits, I think, of Zen, and certainly I'll speak my own experience of Zen, is having a mind that becomes strong enough, or at least aware of its own untapped strengths, that is able really to look at itself honestly, to be honest about who we are, both as a species. You know, our intense self-regard as a species has been catastrophic for many other species. We're probably in a sixth grade extinction event. That's in part because of our species ego, what Peter Singer once called speciesism. The difficulty of being on Turtle Island, that we don't call it Turtle Island, that we mark it with empire and don't look at the genocide of indigenous peoples, who, by the way, lived in a way that suddenly seems pretty good given that we're about to destroy ourselves, or slavery, and other forms, not as toxic, but still plenty toxic forms of labor exploitation, industrialization. You know, look straight on at who we are as a species, you know, as a culture, for men to look at themselves fully and deeply and to own what it has been to be a man for half of our own species, for white people to look at themselves, for human beings to look at themselves in terms of our relationship to all things non-human, to look at ourselves in terms of how we relate to the earth. It's not just there for us. It's not just raw materials at our disposal to use as we see fit. It's that which gives us birth. Our primary stance should have been gratitude. But that it was not means our primary stance then becomes deep forms of practice by which we also atone